Thank you, David. Biology is, of course, involves non-equilibrium processes fundamentally at many levels. So a cell uses chemical energy to produce metabolism. But my talk is not about that. My talk about this is about evolution. In other words, about the large-scale non-equilibrium consequences of the fact that parents bear children, but not the other way around. Now, so this gives rise to evolution, and if you look at, so here is what we are talking about. This is a tree of mammals, and you can see that there is, marginally, not really, anyway. Okay, let's see. Oh yeah, it evolves into some useful function. When you look at this, and this is a time span of several hundred million years, then on this phenotypic level, the arrow of time of this is fairly obvious, if not trivial. It's a branching process that leads to increasing diversity, and you have here these different species at the end of this tree. Now, what is a little bit less obvious is what molecular interactions at the genetic level shape this non-equilibrium process. And this you can see of as what this workshop is about, and this is what my talk is going to be about. Now, at this phenotypic level, there is, you can see that the different species are distinguished by what we would call phenotypic adaptation. So that means this branch here, no, it doesn't work at all. Okay. This branch here developed some phenotypic feature, in this case this trunk, which enables it to do things in its environment that the other species can't do in the same way. So at the phenotypic level, the species evolve characteristic traits. And so there is one fundamental sense in which this non-equilibrium process is not to be understood, and it's not to be understood as something finalistic. We don't need to evoke the fact that these different phenotypes have a purpose, so that the individual wants to get these phenotypes. And this was the great achievement of Darwin, to replace this finalistic approach by a stochastic process that operates at the level of a population. So what we have is that there is new mutations coming in at the level of an individual, and they are completely random, and they are completely undirected. And then there is selection. In other words, the fraction of individuals in a population that carry a mutation that leads to a more advantageous phenotype is increasing. And this all takes place, so this is in the reproduction process itself, because the population is finite, is subject to noise. Let's call this reproductive fluctuations. That go in biology under the slightly odd name of genetic drift. So we have two stochastic processes and one deterministic component that shape the evolution of a population. So you can think of it here as a function of some phenotype. You have something like that. fitness, then at some given point in time, the population spans a given set of varieties, and then there could be a mutation that leads to something a little bit fitter, and then this part of the population is enhanced, and thereby an adaptation can take place. And then you can talk about whether this is sort of what the shape of these fitness landscapes are, whether they have sort of a single peak, so that this evolution can take place in a more continuous way, or whether it's sort of a rugged landscape, so that you get somewhere, but then risk of being stuck, and then one has to debate how evolution can go to the next peak, or the famous theory of Kimura, that at the molecular level, the fitness landscape is essentially flat, and that is neutral evolution, that the majority of changes at the genomic level do not carry appreciable fitness effects. So that would be called a rugged fitness landscape. And we're now just about to begin to assemble experimental evidence on shapes of these fitness landscapes.
But you don't speak your language fluently. Could you say exactly what you mean by fitness?
Okay, I should say it again exactly. Thank you very much. So fitness is, or rather fitness differences, govern the differences, so they're just different, relative differences in reproduction rate of partial of individuals in subpopulations of a population. So you have two different phenotypes in a population, they have two different growth rates. So if this deterministic, and this difference in growth rate is a fitness difference. So let's think about it as something which is just defined up to a constant as a difference in reproductive success of subpopulations that carry a given phenotype. And hence, they will lead in the long term, if these differences are large enough, if they overcome these stochasticities that are competing with them, they will lead to survival of the fittest. And then with a new mutation, of course, the game is open again, and this competition between these different subpopulations starts again. So there is still one in this picture. There is one thing that is missing, and that is if you think about it at a molecular level, there are mutations, say from a given letter in the genome, from a letter A to a letter C, and there are many of these mutations. How do they build up a phenotypic change? In other words, how do many mutations make up an adaptation of a large phenotype? So we need to go from the level of genomic changes to changes at the level of phenotypes. In other words, to phenotypic adaptations, which is what is depicted here. And it's clear that there will be more than one genomic change that make up a phenotype like this nice trunk of the elephant. So although we can think of these single mutations as being favored and hence having success in a population, it's very difficult to imagine how a phenotypic adaptation can be built up from these smaller genomic events unless we think of them having multiple correlations between themselves. In other words, one change that makes this a little bit more like a trunk will influence the fate of subsequent changes in the genome. So what has to come together with this is multiple genomic interactions. And these interactions govern these changes and lead to what I would like to call the non-equilibrium build-up of temporal correlations. And these temporal correlations then lead to phenotype, and they generate our error of time. And what I want to show you is just a few examples of what kind these interactions are and what kind these correlations are that we are looking at.
So you're saying without these correlations, there's no way to cause?
Well, I'm just saying, so we need to explain something large, coherent, from a number of small steps. And the most natural way is to think that these individual steps are correlated in the sense that one step paves the terrain for the subsequent steps. And I will show you an example of that. I'm not claiming that there's no way or that to do it otherwise, but I think it's an easy logical way, or a possible logical way, to think about this. And I will show you examples. Before I do that, let me show you another example of an evolutionary tree. And in fact, so this is the evolutionary tree of the influenza virus A. And this is a time span between 1983 and 1997. In other words, about 16 winters where this influenza evolves and attacks us in ever-changing clones. And
how are these trees made? What is the...
So this particular tree was made by sequencing these different isolates from different years. In fact, for this tree, we have an advantage that we didn't have for the previous trees, that we can also... And the WHO has collected these samples since 1949 or something. So they have frozen all these strands from different years, and they can be taken from the freezer and reanalyzed. And so this is what makes this sequence tree. And in fact, I have cheated a little bit. Some of them might have protested why this mammal's tree looked so strange on the previous transference. I've just copied this little part of the tree here and added these mammals' names. So what this the reason for this is that I think it's a truly remarkable fact that we can talk about these processes that take place in vastly different timescales. So here it's 15 years versus hundreds of millions of years in the same terminology, in the same conceptual framework. So this framework really spans has a large span of different timescales. And I want to come back to this.
Before we leave this for a second, can you just tell us how many nucleotides have to change before you kind of get back to one of those vertical bars? How have you done that?
I want to tell you much more about this tree in the course of the talk, so let me come back to that. So my first example is gene regulatory networks. And in particular, a part of these regulatory networks that we heard about in the course of our program earlier this week by Eric Davidson, that form the major body plans. In other words, well, whether an animal looks has an anterior and a posterior, or whether it has a different kind of symmetry, whether it has a spinal cord, or things like that, these major determinants of large body regions. And look at these fossil, what Eric Davidson says, and there's a sort of course we can debate about details, but so this is the point of view taken, is that they all formed within a period roughly between 650 million years ago and 550 million years ago. In other words, prior to the Cambrian. And since then, in terms of these large constituents, not so much has happened. Although, of course, at the level of species, a lot has happened, not at lower levels. So the question is, this process, which happened during a particular window of time and then has been frozen, can we explain this temporal dynamics in a sort of mechanistic way at the level of gene regulation? So I should tell you what gene regulation is. So here the elementary constituents of our interactions are genes. Regulatory networks. And genes interact by regulation. And one way they do this is called, perhaps the most fundamental way, is transcriptional regulation. And so here is a short cartoon of that. You have one gene somewhere has a region that is transcribed and eventually is transformed into a, eventually codes for a protein. And mostly in front of that region, somewhere in between, as sometimes as well in between, there are specific short sites on the DNA where another protein made by another gene, could be somewhere completely else in the genome, can bind. And this binding can catalyze the transcription of this gene, in other words, enhance the rate considerably, or it can repress and this transcription. And this is called why these sites are called enhancers. The reason why this is a complicated process, and it's not always easy to say. You could think, well, let's just look in the genome, look where these enhancers are, then we know all these interactions. The reason, there are many reasons why this is not an easy task, and there are many reasons why this is one of the fundamental topics of this workshop. One of them is that you can have something like cooperative interactions. I mean, you have one side here, the completely different position of the genome, and together they generate maybe a sufficient binding affinity to bind maybe one or two of these proteins and do this catalyzing function. But of course, seen on the genomic string, they're maybe quite far away and hence not being recognized as doing something together. Yes.
Sorry, I have an elementary question. Is it happening in an individual or in a population? And if it happens in a population, what is the minimum size of the population?
No, this happens in every cell. This is how the activity of one gene, if this gene is active, it produces this protein, this so-called transcription factor, and that can trigger the activity of another gene. And it's clear that we know that we need to have these temporal patterns in order to build something. So,
is it happening in one sea urchin or in a...
This happens in every cell of every sea urchin, in every cell of us, all the time. For example, whenever the cell does something, and in fact, the biggest problem for the cell is to shut down most of the genes, because every cell has the entire genetic code. If all these genes were producing their proteins at the same time, it would be a big mess. So only the ones that are needed for the function that cell, maybe in a particular tissue or at a particular stage of the cell cycle, has to perform, only that number of genes should be turned on at that point in time. And this is one way how the activity of one gene can influence the activity of another gene. So here, there is an example of such interactions. So there is a set of sort of core genes, and there is these incoming arrows that say that either the action of one of them is positively triggering the action of this gene or is maybe repressing the action. So in here, in this case, for example, you have this gene, it transcribes, it produces the protein binds again to the regulatory region of the gene itself. And so this is a negative feedback loop, and there's a number of these interactions. Now, these networks, or this particular subnetwork, that was the finding of Davidson and Irwin, is something which is highly conserved. Even between two animals, whose common ancestor dates back to this period between 650 and 550 million years, where these fundamental units may have formed. So you see here, this is in two completely different species. So one wiring diagram, one diagram of influences, and here in the other species, and here on the lower panel is sort of the common part of these diagrams. So this says that for this particular example, both the genes, both the constituents, the nodes of this network, as well as the links between them are highly conserved. And this is what they call network kernels. And they are being defined as some subparts of course, a much larger network, which contain regulatory genes. In other words, the genes that encode transcription factors. That's why they can sort of have these multiple interactions within the subunit. They are connected to the major sort of body domains, or forming of these body domains. So in this case, what this particular network does is it helps the embryo to distinguish between the endoderm and the mesoderm, which are sort of two different cell layers that form during embryonic evolution, and that then each of them later gives rise to a specific set of organs. So this is a very early differentiation. So they have to do with these major body domains. They are unique in the organism, and they are highly connected, highly recursive, and this leads to their evolutionary stability. In other words, if you take out or try to alter something, you mess up the whole thing. And this is why it's so highly conserved. So in this case, the buildup of these correlations in some evolutionary period took place in one evolutionary period between 650 maybe and 530 or something million years. So here you have the buildup of these correlations. And then these interactions lead to a dynamic freezing of this object. And in this case, it's both at the level of nodes and links.
So this diagram of the inner long ring on your blackboard.
Yes.
This kind of long-range interaction, are they nearby in space, like every period of the helix or something?
Well, they can be thousands of base pairs away. They're sort of the details of how many turns it is, it doesn't matter anymore. So it's not yet generally understood what are, and this is one of our topics, what are the grammatical rules, so to say, by which these sites are placed and how they...
Is that conserving?
So that...
You're conserving the logical structure of these networks, but you're also conserving some of the physical...
So here, in this case, the the genes are conserved. In other words, you can find them by orthology. So what is here denoted by a common name is genes that have a significant sequence similarity, and these links are conserved. Of course, not all of them are verified with the same amount of experimental evidence, so you can debate about details, but this is sort of the message that comes from this part of the diagram. And I want to contrast this with...
the strength of the links conserved?
Most of them have not been measured so quantitatively. So there is still, of course, it's hard to measure these things in vivo. So in how much the strength matters for each of them, that could be a matter of debate. So this part is sort of giving a complementary message. So here you see again one of these activation repression networks, and this is at an even earlier stage of the embryo, in this case a fly, in this case an insect embryo. So the two examples come here from fly and from another insect called Nazonia. They're also reasonably far away, but of course much closer than the two ones that we saw in the previous example. And so this is the very early stage of the embryo where it has to decide what is the front and what's the back of it. And this is done by some genes. So in particular, so you have like some genes that are active mostly in the rear part and then some genes that are active mostly in the front part. And it, essentially, so you see there are some very few genes at the beginning, and then they give rise to a whole cascade of downstream genes, and they make then this anterior-posterior patterning that is characteristic of this body plan. And so the same thing, of course, happens here. The body plan is quite similar. It has a front, it has a back, it has this segmental patterning. And so the very initial step is of course a very fundamental step where the front and the back of this embryo has to be decided, and it's done by one gene in Drosophila, but by a different gene in Nazonia. So here you have, although the sort of the function of this thing is conserved, the genes that make up this pattern are changed. We don't really know what kind of fitness effects may be involved there, but this is an amount of plasticity at an even earlier level than sort of the subsequent differentiation of the body plan. So what I want to say with this is it's not at all obvious a priori where the things are that are highly conserved and where the things are that that are plastic. It doesn't go by a temporal, by an obvious temporal order. Let me just show you.
So the OTT gene is also present in Drosophila, but the decoy gene was shown as important for until having Drosophila is actually not present in what. So it's an interesting commentary.
Yeah. Here you see, this is just to show you very briefly the beautiful kind of experiments by which people verify this. So not only does the gene change, in this case, bicoid to OTD here in Nazonia. So what you see here is the levels of RNA at different stages. And in fact, this is before the formation of the embryo. So here is the egg cell. So you can see that something is given, is triggered by the mother. So this is a maternal thing. So the point in time switches as well. So it switches from something that the embryo expresses by its own dynamics, from something that comes as an external trigger to the mother. So there's a quite drastic change of the dynamics from something that comes as external to the embryo to something that it's generating by its own dynamical process. This is the egg a little bit later. You see that this this OTD is present both in the front and in the rear, and then it leads to this is the embryo at a later stage, so it triggers then other things. So when we want to think of it in terms of scaling, so have here sort of different length scales, and we have on small scales the genome, and on large scale the phenotype, and here we have the amount of selection. So when we have relatively we have a lot of things that are not under selection, so here would be neutrality. So then everything that I draw in this diagram is very much under debate, but it's clear there is a fair amount of neutrality in the genome. There are changes which don't have a drastic dynamical fitness effect. Phenotypes mostly are there for a reason. They are selected for. The trunk of the elephant is there because it makes use of it. You can think of these gene networks as something at an intermediate stage. But I've shown you that there is a fair span of fitness effects between something that seems to be highly fixed by the dynamics to some things that are fairly flexible and exchangeable. So when we think about this scale dependence, there is no clear-cut way, say, from an asymptotic freedom at small scales to confinement at large scales, but there is something at intermediate scales of probably a kind of hierarchy of coupling constants that we don't understand yet very well. I think I can now turn this screen up. So second example has to do with two of these jargon term epistasis and plasticity. In other words, that the fitness effect of a mutation can be influenced both by the environment, this is called plasticity, or by other genes, by the interactions with other genes, and this is called epistasis. So, other genes. So, to make the analogy, if we have an easing model, the spins that can be influenced, the energy for spin can be influenced by external factors, in this case the magnetic field, and it can be influenced by the couplings with other spins. So this is the epistasis in the easing model, and this is the plasticity. And so the question is, however, to which extent in the genome can we quantify that? And we're just also only beginning to be able to quantify these things. But I want to tell you about one experiment on bacterial evolution that Susie Raymold and Lenski did a few years ago. So what they did, they wanted to quantify these dependencies in bacterial evolution. So what they did is they took a number of different bacterial populations, let's call them background, genetic backgrounds, and they took five genetic backgrounds, then they subjected these five different background population to different what you could call recent ecological histories. In other words, they grew them on two different sugars, glucose and maltose. And they did this for about 1,000 generations. So it's a finite amount of time, so let's call this the ecological history. Then they introduced into these genomes mutations, 18 different mutations, and they placed them randomly in the genome. So 18 mutations, and then they grew them again for a short period of time, 40 generations, just enough so that they could measure fitness differences between the mutation and the unmutated state, so that took them 40 generations, and this was again done on glucose or on maltose. So this you could call the current environment. And then they were able to ask questions: what is the fitness effect of such a mutation? How does it depend on the recent ecological history? In other words, how did it interact with the genetic changes that had formed in the past? And how does it interact, and how much does it depend on the environment? So this is a rather fundamental sort of way how to say how much of these different types of interactions do we have in our system. And the finding, I think, so let's see what they could measure. So if you have, so here is your different, the two different current environments, glucose and maltose, and here is the fitness effect of a mutation. If the fitness effect was neither dependent on the current environment nor on any other genetic changes that had taken place somewhere in the genome before, then we would find and I draw here two different lines that distinguish the evolutionary history. So one of them is the glucose grown, the other is the maltose grown. Then things would just, the fitness effect would have some value, but it's independent of both the environment and the ecological history. So this would be no epistasis and no plasticity. If we have epistasis and no plasticity, this diagram would look like this. In other words, the fitness effect could be different for these different ecological histories because they have accumulated different other genotypes, due to their past evolution, if there is an interaction, then the fitness effect of these random mutations is important, so that this is a random sample, so to say, they are not placed in a specific place, would depend on that. Vice versa, if you have only plasticity and no epistasis, it would look like this. And if you have both, then the fitness effect could be anything like this. Now they could count for these 18 different mutations how many fell in these different classes. So nine of the 18 had none of these effects, and they were mostly very weak fitness effects anyway. So this number here was small, so there is a background of near-neutral changes which don't have pronounced, neither pronounced fitness effects nor pronounced correlation. Epistasis, but no environment dependence was in three cases. This case didn't occur at all, and this case was rather common. So the message from this experiment in bacteria is that epistasis and epistasis combined with environmental effects are common. So it's really, and of course here we precisely have again the same thing. During this ecological history, there are some mutations, some genetic changes occurring, and they determine the fitness effect of these subsequent changes. In other words, they lead to build-up of these temporal correlations that then can make different phenotypes. So these different changes that are taking place at different points in time are far from independent. So at least as far as these local genomic changes is concerned, we should rather think of this fitness landscape as a seascape. In other words, it can change in time because in this ecological history, other things change. So there is a fair amount of J couplings in the genome, but of course, what makes it more difficult than physics is that there is no principle of locality. There's no forward light cone or something that nicely shapes our influences. These JIJs can be, as we have seen in this one diagram of on regulatory interactions, between two rather different points in the genome. Yes?
Question about the epistasis. You can see why it would be adaptive to react to the present environment, that, you know, changes that help you to be in that environment and be successful in that environment would seem to, you know, be useful to the organism. But it would seem as if with epistasis, you're really looking at, you know, present-day changes being influenced by what the situation was in the past. And you can see that sometimes that might be good for the organism, and sometimes it might be destructive. Because that, at least coming through it from the outside, just listening to the nice presentation, you know, the thought that occurs to one, and I'm wondering, is it true that sometimes the effects of epistasis are to enhance survivability or enhance success, and sometimes it's the other way around?
Yes, I mean, we haven't talked here about the sign of these effects, but it can, of course, if the combined effect is negative, then, for example, for this ecological history, this mutation, if it has a negative fitness effect, it is unlikely to have success in the population. This kind of amplification process would then probably mean, at least if the fitness effect is strong enough, that this mutation would just be weeded out from the population. So in the end, what we see is the successful combinations, the successful mutations and their successful combinations. So the mechanism is that maybe something here occurred in this ecological history, some mutation or some change occurred, and this then works together with one of these mutations to make that subpopulation, to make a better living for that subpopulation, in other words, to increase its fitness. And the way they measured this fitness was in an obvious way. They placed these two, the mutant and the wild type, in together in a petri dish, and they look after 40 generations who is the surviving one.
18 mutations. This is introduced chemically somehow?
Well, this is a...
My question is whether you know that it is action on every single bacterium, or whether afterwards you have some heterogeneous...
Well, you introduce that to say, one bacterium. You grow that bacterium first until you have a large bunch of them which have that identical mutation. Then you take that bunch and sort of combine it with a wild type, let them compete in a petri dish, and then you look. So all these, the actual experiments and this introduction of the mutations, that's a rather sort of complicated process I can tell you later about. So the question is this something which, so in bacteria we can do these experiments. Let me tell you briefly what people are doing, what one can do in higher organisms. Of course, this kind of direct information on the temporal succession of events, and hence on this coupling, is not available. So my second example comes again from flies. So if you just have in flies, of course, evolution is much slower. So it takes these shaping processes take place of the order of hundreds of thousands or millions of years. So all we have is two genomes, say from two species. Let's take two related ones, say Melanogaster and Simulans, and then we can compare their genomes and say we observe in one place a change from an A to a C. Just on the basis of that, it's of course impossible to say whether this was something that occurred by chance. In other words, there was a mutation in the individual, but there was no fitness effect, and it just sort of diffused through the population. At some point, we happen to see the majority of the individuals carrying that letter in the other species without there being sort of a large fitness effect, or whether this change occurred for a reason. So what can we do? Well, there's one thing that is people are doing now increasingly as genomic sequencing gets so cheap that people can sequence more than one genome from one species. This kind of information is going to increase a lot as well. Then we can see like how many. So now we can see, for example, whether this letter C is shared by all the individuals in our sample, or whether there is maybe a situation where part of the individuals share this letter and part of the individuals do not share this letter. So, in other words, we can now count what people call a substitution, and this is called a polymorphism because all these genomes from one species, say male, do not have the same letter, but sort of this diffusion process between these two alternatives is just in the make. And this is a minority of the cases. So most of these diffusion processes, most genomic sites are decided. So there is one letter, otherwise sequencing wouldn't make a lot of sense if everything was different from individual to individual. But occasionally there are these sites in the genome where not all individuals share the same letter. And then we can draw a histogram of these cases. Here's the probability. And here is just if we have a sample of, say, 10 individuals, we can say either zero of them have a difference from this other species, so-called outgroup, or say up to 10. And these histograms always look roughly like this. That means most genomic positions, that they're all the same. There is some number of substitutions, and an even lesser number is these polymorphisms. So what we and then we can take these kind of frequency spectra of polymorphisms. So what we did here is we just counted the number of cases where so this would be all of them would have the same. This would be a 10. So here would be maybe 3 out of 10, and so on. And then we built a count histogram from them. And of course, that contains some dynamical information on the fitness effects underlying these changes, because we can compare this now with models. So here is, let me put two simple models. So here is, let's just assume that there is only 2 letters. And we call the fraction of the population that carries one of them, we call it X, and the other letter is called by 1 minus X. So here this would be 3 over 10 versus 7 over 10. So X is 3 over 10. And then there is this diffusion process. And suppose this is the fitter allele, so most of the time the population wants to be here, but occasionally there is a mutation, and it makes it some way into the population, but it's diffusion against the barrier. So on larger time scales, the deterministic forces win. Maybe sometimes there can be what people call a deleterious mutation, that despite a fitness disadvantage, the diffusion wins. So this is really sort of a standard competition between stochasticity and the deterministic parts, but then you also could have that advantageous mutations are taking place. Now, if you just look, and I don't want to go into any details, at what this means for our diagnostic spectra, they depend a little bit on this, because when you have this case that you have your fitness grade, so you are at the better allele, so a mutation would be deleterious, then you still see this boundary layer of diffusion. In other words, you would still see something over here, but you won't see a lot over here. On the other hand, if you have this case that you go from downhill to uphill, then you would probably see more of a support of the spectrum also here. And the mathematics of this, of course, can be worked out on the basis of this diffusion process. And we can, again, sort of now play different models against these observed spectra. So, for example, one model we could play is where we mimic these different ecological backgrounds. In other words, we drive the genome by a stochastic change in the directionality of a fitness effect. So this could mimic the fact that other changes take place and they have an interaction, JIJ, with the site in question. And so then we would have sort of models where the selection is time independent and models where the selection has a time dependence in itself. And then we can, so people are inventing different models and comparing them to these spectra, and we can learn something about what the distribution of fitness effects is. And in particular, when you compare a driven model, there is a non-equilibrium driving through a time-dependent fitness function with a time-independent function, you find actually evidence, again on a genome-wide scale, that the selection itself is something time-dependent. So this finding from bacteria is also something that resonates with data from genomic analysis. So I guess my time is nearly at the end. So I want to now do what I promised, namely to come back to influenza. This is my last example. coming. So but influenza, so what you see here, this tree is actually not a tree built from the entire influenza genome, but just from the so-called hemagglutinin domain. So hemagglutinin is a protein, it's fairly complicated, and in particular, it has a subdomain somewhere here that governs the interaction with the cell of the host that is infecting. So this is the part of the viral genome that is most in competition with the human or host immune system. And so this is one part which is probably highly interaction dominated in the sense we have just been discussing in the previous examples. And what I want to show you in this example, that these interactions can actually be used to predict evolution. So evolution is no longer just this sort of historical endeavor, but it can be used to, for example, and this was the message of the paper by Bush et al. That appeared a number of years ago in Science. It can be used, for example, to predict what kind of vaccine should people make for next winter. So like manifest medical interest in this kind of studies. So here they take the subset of, in fact, it's 18 codons, so 18 times 3 nucleotide positions that make 18 amino acids that are most responsible for this docking to the host cell. How could they identify these 18 codons? That was the ingenious idea of these people. They just looked which of the of these amino acids evolved faster than the rest of the background. The idea is, of course, they are in this race with the immune system. So while normally lots of this viral protein needs to be conserved, it also has its kernels that we have seen it also has things that it better not change. But these things, which are in constant interaction with the human immune system, it better changes. And so in fact, sort of the recipe for success of viral strands competing with others is here that they be newer, so that the human immune system is less adapted. So you could call this a disruptive or repulsive interactions between these different strands. So, and this leads to a higher fraction of the changes actually encoding for amino acid changes rather than sort of third codon position changes which do not code for an amino acid change. So by measuring this fraction of changes that make a new amino acid to changes that do not do so, they could identify these 18 codons, and then this tree is just made from these 18 codons. In fact, maybe look at this left tree first. So this is for a restricted number of years. So this ends at the influenza season 1993 to 1994, and so as usual in a given winter, there is not one strand, but there's a few. There's probably many which are sort of have very small populations, but then the WHO just samples and there's outbreaks, and so we see here the ones that have a significant fraction of the population, and they can be, so you can make a tree, so you can look at their relative similarities and connect them to these strands in the past, and so the question is, on the basis of this information for 1 year, can we predict what's happening in coming years? So what Bush and Walter Fitch and co-workers did, they just looked of these existing strands, which had made the farthest progress from the past, the highest number of point mutations within this subset of 18 codons. Of course, this would be nonsensical to do it for the entire genome, but within this interaction-dominated part, they just looked at the maximum number of changes. And so this was happened to be this Shangdong isolate. And then, if you follow the tree a few more years, you can look which of the ones that you found in 93, 94, because most of them will have died out. So this is another interesting facet of this tree. None of these trends last for very long. The average lifetime is about 1.5 years. So, it's obvious from our interaction model. It would be very hard to explain by this pattern would be very hard to explain without interactions. If you just have a random decay process, then maybe at some point also the whole tree could die out. But the fact that the tree sort of moves on while each strand has a finite lifetime is of course precisely reflecting this race between immune system and these strands. So here you can now look at the genotypes that you see in a subsequent season, just look which of them resembles most closely one of these guys over here. In other words, you can predict that this guy informs most of the has most information on the strands in a subsequent season. So in other words, a recipe to make the vaccine for next year, or one of these recipes that is discussed and that was proposed in these papers, is to just look which of these guys is most distant from the past and make your vaccine against this guy. Because this might be most virulent in the coming year. So this... This example shows that it's precisely these, and it's again, of course, this temporal buildup of correlations that we discussed in the bacteria case. Here you have also this past ecology that shapes whether new mutations have a good or bad effect in this competition between these different viral strands. And what I find amusing, very interesting about this example, that it can be used to extrapolate the process in the future, which you could not do if it was a simple random process, an equilibrium, just a decay process. Well, so what they did at the time is they looked at, so this is the picture of one of these cases, but of course you can take different pairings of sort of query year and prediction year, and it was a statistical correlation. Then they can make a statistical test to see whether it's significant and how it performs with respect to other possible tests and so on. So, of course, it was not a 100% hit rate, but this is a stochastic process, so it better not be. So it's again sort of this, the interaction nature of this problem that makes this predictability. If it were just a neutral random process, then any of these guys would have equal likelihood to be conserved here in the future. So what I wanted to show with these examples was that we're using, on the one hand, evolution to understand these functional units. On the other hand, these different functional units have their effect on the evolutionary dynamics. And the transfer of, or the acquisition of new knowledge really goes both ways. So we have now the functional correlations imply evolutionary interactions and imply the strong non-equilibrium behavior. On the other hand, we can use the evolutionary information to learn why these complicated networks have the structure and how we can understand this this structure, which really without a dynamical information would be very hard to grasp. So there is... But of course, the quantitative information of these processes is just beginning to build up. So to put this in perspective with cosmology, so we heard in Bob Kirshner's talk a few weeks ago, so that already centuries ago there was this guy Tycho, so he knew all the stars of the universe from boyhood, and then could, and then later they found a few additional stars, but he knew them essentially. So compared with that, we are still sort of this in a cave, and we just have sort of a very restricted. So for example, the information of these on these networks is immensely complicated, and we know case examples. And the most difficult part at present is to extrapolate what of them is typical and what is not. So we don't have yet the benefit of knowing all the stars. On the other hand, this sort of disruptive, the nature of this branching process has created so many differences. So flies are really so different from bacteria and so on, that it has, that we have what maybe the astronomers, so we have occasional glimpses also in parallel universes. And I don't know enough about cosmology to know whether there can be information transfer between coexisting universes or how to quantify it. So we have rather these small angle views in coexisting universes. Well, maybe I should stop now. Thank you.
The networks that you mentioned formed at the time of the Cambrian, is it understood how inevitable they were, or could have some different networks have formed and then frozen and taken over and came to manufacture?
I think it's not clear how inevitable they were. You see some, you know, symmetry groups that formed. There may have been others which died out. So the point of view of Davidson and Irwin is that essentially the ones that formed were kept. And so that neither did a lot of them die out, nor did a lot of them come later. So the fact that no new ones come later is, of course, sort of one of these correlation effects. Once successful body plans had been formed, the newcomers had no more chance. The dynamics in this formative period, whether this was exhausted sort of the possibilities of phase space or was just a sparse sampling, I don't know a good answer.
How much of human cultural evolution can be organized in these terms?
Well, of course, it's there are some things that are similar. There's randomness, there's stochasticity, there is selection. So, for example, you think about fashion or something. So, something starts, and then there can be time-dependent selection. The fashion is maybe a good example. So, something which is in fashion sort of after a while has the same fate as these viral strands. It gets out of fashion. Something new replaces it. However, there's also differences. So, the reproduction process does not go via sort of in this time-ordered way, so that sort of the genetic code is given with mutations to the descendants. So opinions have sort of part of the dynamics the same, and part of this dynamics is different. And the biggest difference is the nature of the reproduction process. So but you can write down, and people do that. So people write down diffusion equations for that, and you can study cultural evolution. The evolution of language is a similar example, where you also have mutations. Fitness effects of these mutations. You have presumably a number of neutral mutations, because any two languages, have essentially sort of similar complexity. So a lot of it is just probably neutral changes. But then you have this canalization. Once you have made some decision at one level of the grammar, it governs other subsequent. For example, it may govern phonetic effects.
Well, there's several time in linguistics, which is, you know, subject, verb, object, object, subject, verb, but never back.
Well, so maybe this is sort of the kernels that were the different sort of groups of languages decided at early points in time, and then which also had this canalizing effect. Once you decide what your basic word order is, you're not going to change it every day. Other things in the language are changed at a much higher rate.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.